Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm rocking for in the Duck South Studios. Second time today. Ramsey, hope you don't mind. I had a Thursdays with Rob instead of Mondays with Rob this morning.
Man, any day's good with Rob.
Especially when the conversation is mainly about yoga pants, and you're hearing Rob's opinion on that.
Yeah, I hope Rob didn't get a pair.
That's why he's been losing weight,
so he'll fit in yoga pants.
Holy man, he's lost like 60 or 70 pounds. It's unreal.
Maybe it's just them yoga pants making him look thin.
Sure, I will have to give Rob something, though. In that podcast this morning, Rob talked about putting together what's called the Duck South Olympics, which I think is a awesome idea this summer. One, you know, July, August, when nobody's busy anymore, things are slowing down right there before dove season. You know, a couple of things he talked about it for events. He wanted to have the water waiter run and the 40-yard dash. Everybody talks about how fast they are. The decoy throwing contest, extreme arguing, and not a debate, you know, formal debate. It's extreme arguing, you know, it's on emotional topics like Ford versus Chevy, Benelli versus Beretta, you know, stuff like that. I think it's a great idea.
I think it'd be a great idea for a get together. The entertainment value alone would be monumentous. I would probably not participate, but I would dang sure be there dispensing of cold beverages and watching. That would be the entertainment value would be immense. I'll be a judge.
That's right. That's probably what I would do with all the guys, the godfathers of the podcast, bring them in as judges. Let them judge all the contests. Like you and Cooksey and Pat Pitt and Justin Martin and Troy, some of the guys in the past has been on. We've done these stories with bring you guys in and make y'all the judges.
I think it'd be a great idea. It'd be fun. That's for darn sure.
Well, hey, when are you? Aren't you leaving sometime in the next week or two? Are you headed to South Africa?
Yeah, I'm home for. I'm home for about 13 or 14 more days. It's funny you should bring that up because I've been home a good long stretch this time. I've been home since mid-March or so. Got back from Azerbaijan. People remember those talks back then when me and Jake were over there. I came on home and got a lot of work done, man. I mean, golly, did I get some stuff done and stuff that needed to be done and got some stuff not done. Just got some stuff caught up and relaxed and feeling at home. But the other day, my bride said, "Are you feeling okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine. I'm just my normal, cheerful, wonderful self." And she goes, no, something. And I just thought I was my normal, cheerful, wonderful self. And she says, "Are you ready to leave again?" I didn't think about it until she said it. When she said it, I'm like, "Yeah, I guess I am. I guess I'm ready to be back on the road again. I've been home nearly 2 months." And so, yeah, but in a couple of weeks, family and I are going to Africa for a few days. Going to do a little sightseeing, a little fun tour over there. And, you know, Nita and I went a couple of years ago for my 50th birthday, and we always wanted to take some kids. And thought we were going to get all three of them, but Duncan is in the U.S. Marine Corps. He's going to be, at that time, he's going to be, as we leave for Africa, he's going to be leaving for Okinawa. And so he's not going to make this trip, but he and I got something else planned when his schedule allows. And then when they come home, I'm going to meet some clients and Jake Latondras and Ryan Bassham, and we're going to do a run and gun in the Republic of South Africa, several stops to shoot game birds and ducks and geese. And after about 6 days of that, we're going to hop over to Zululand and hunt birds for a few more days. Then come on back home, and I'll be home for about a week to regroup before the whole Argentina thing starts. So I'm kind of back on the road in a couple of weeks. And but I got everything I needed to get done. And that's the most important thing. Everything I really needed to get done, needed to be home and at the office before, I got done. And you know, Rocky, last week we were talking about, you know, this whole get ducks thing and all, and talking about John, we started off talking about John LaMonaco, which was just real easy. Start talking about the influence of people. And that I've said it a million times, and I'll say it again. You know, it's been one of the most rewarding parts of this whole Get Ducks experience for me has been the people. The people that come into your lives, the people that affect your lives. And, you know, y'all know I love to shoot ducks. Anybody that's ever been a blind with me knows I love to shoot ducks. But the older I get, the less, you know, the less just the physical act of killing a feathered creature with a brain the size of a pea becomes. Yes, it's fun. Yes, it's, you know, but the chase and the elements and the challenges and the environments and the species and the habitats and the cultures and all that stuff, but the people. You know, it's always just such a profound thing. And John LaMonaco is a very, very, very good example of that. But before I continue telling y'all about John, you know, I'm it never ceases to amaze me. You know, there you are minding your own business. There's a knock at the door. You open it, bam, life slaps you in the face and reminds you life's short. It's short. And times, you know, the times you enjoy and the things you enjoy and the people you love and care for, you know, it's easy to live life and just think of yourself in this foreverness. And it's just not the case. You know, last night, Dunk was supposed to be home at a certain time. And I said, well, let's go watch a movie. We went and watched a movie, and we got out. We got a notification. Well, the flight been delayed. You know, finally, he come off the flight in Jackson, Mississippi about 1:30 in the morning. We got home at 2:30 and caught up. We all went to bed about 3. And he's home for a brief period of time. We get to see him. But, you know, unlike a kid going to college or moving out, you know, he's going to Okinawa, Japan. I guarantee you, I'm going to get to see Okinawa before it's over with, because the wife's already said we're going to see him over there. And but we don't know. We don't know when he's coming back home. He don't know when he's coming back home. It's just crazy to see your son, one of your favorite hunting partner. You know, it's just crazy to look here in the den and see a couple of duffel bags. Literally a couple of duffel bags fit on the back seat of a Volkswagen, and that's his life. It's all just confined right there. And he, you know, in service to his country, he doesn't know where he knows where he's going, but he don't know from there where he's going or what he's going to do or when he's going to come back. And that's a very humbling position. So that's why I just remind people all the time, you know, life's short. And you know, cherish those times with the people. You know, don't wish away, you guys with 3-year-olds and 8-year-olds and, you know, wishing them to be a little older, wishing them to be a little more capable, wait, you know, wishing for them to be in the duck blind. Man, don't wish the days away. They're going to pass before you know it anyway. Take every moment you get. And I was also reminded this week, I'll tell you this, and I'm going to get on to the story about John. I just was reminded again, years ago, we started hunting in Netherlands, and the first two clients I had go to Netherlands, Rocky, you know Mr. John, Big John, I call him, to differentiate from Mr. John of Monaco, who I'll later talk about, but Big John. He and one of his buddies, Chris, who have become very close friends, they've manned the booth at local shows. They've been on many hunts with me now, and you know, but they're the kind of clients that we love to actually shoot together. Although Big John will tell you a different story sometimes. And
one of my dad's best friends.
Yeah, what a small world that makes it. You know what I'm saying? But what an old school gentleman and successful person in many ways, many ways in life. Big duck hunter. And just a heck of a guy to share a blind with. But I didn't know this when they were the first two clients to go to Netherlands. And we just had a wonderful time. I tell you one of these funny stories. But I took an immediate liking to John. I guarantee if he was telling the story, he'd tell you a totally different version. Big John would tell you a totally different version of this story because for whatever reason, we were hunting this field and there was a lot of traffic of graylags, a lot of traffic, a lot of geese. And this was the day, by the way, that they staked some live mallard decoys out in the field. And I had Cooper, so I had walked around in the dark thinking, oh, my gosh, what is she going to do when she barks a bird and goes out and one of these mallards flinch or something? You know, it's like, what's she going to grab them up? So I walked around the dark with her on a leash just letting her look and sniff these birds thinking, you know, will she know the difference? Who knows? We'll find out. And so we started hunting. For whatever reason, the guides over there put Big John in a blind, like a 4x4, literally a 4x4 blind, 4x4x4 blind, where he could sit and look one way as the birds were trafficking. And for whatever reason, they put Chris and I in some layout blinds about, I don't know, 10, 15 yards away, just freaking knee-high fireweed or stinging nettle. And which was great concealment, long as you didn't touch anything. And you know, John was getting all the shoot. Long story short, we'd be sitting there getting ready, and John would shoot. And finally, Chris and I, you know, about the 10th or 15th goose hit the ground, Cooper picked up of his that we didn't even see. I said, "Let's go over there and see if there's room in that blind for all three of us, Chris." Chris, big old boy too. We go over there, John, like, y'all go back. I'm just fine. So we squeeze into this blind, but the only way it works, and I mean, boy, we like sardines in this little blind, and the only way it worked, as it turns out, I was looking the way the geese were coming, and Chris was looking the way the geese were coming, but us all lied. Then their John was looking the way we'd been sitting. So as the geese are coming up, John, like, where they at? Where they at? Where they at? I'm like, just, you'll know. We'll tell you when it's time to stand up and turn around. I mean, he, you know, and what he realized is when we flinched, he better be standing up and turn around if he's going to get a shot off. And we, of course, Chris and I were loving it. John was just giving us the devil. And look, don't think he was handicapped because he wasn't handicapped one bit. Those two men can shoot. And we racked up a very, very impressive number of geese. And wouldn't you know it, just to tell you a little bit about Cooper, those live mallards didn't faze her. They had stakes hammered in the ground and a pair of mallards tethered to each stake. And she would run around them. You know, she'd make the mark, and she just didn't even faze her. She didn't even register on her screen to fetch one of those calling mallards. But the ducks didn't know that. And so John crunched a graylag that fell out there kind of behind us about 50 yards in our center. There was a pair of mallards right on line. And she was going full steam and was just going to hurtle over those pair of mallards. Well, they didn't know. Last we saw them, they were disappearing in the distance, tethered, pulling a stake. And you know, they didn't know the plan. She brought the goose back, and later, our host says, "Where are my mallards?" And we pointed down the canal. Last time we saw them, they were way down yonder. And sure enough, we drove over and found them. They had landed and were sitting there, just, you know, doing whatever ducks do, sitting in a canal. And he went out there and got them and put them back in the cage, you know, and they were happy as could be. And but anyway, had some. And I'll tell you another Big John story in Netherlands. He loved this, and John was the kind of guy. Now look, we became close friends real quick over little things like this, and he'd rub some salt in your wounds. But we had a great 4 days, just bam, 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 just unbelievable, great 4 days shooting ducks and geese over in the Netherlands. And on the last day, we went out to a little barnacle spot. The birds were coming off a big reservoir. The farmer called, said he had barnacles, and told us to come get them off the spill. And so we went and set up, and it was real clear, real obvious. As soon as the birds started coming off, barnacles like real big water. They like to roost on real big open water. So we were sitting about a quarter mile, half mile away from this big reservoir, and the birds were coming off. It became very obvious immediately that they weren't coming to this field. And what we found out is about a mile away, another farmer had disked under some sugar beets. All the geese in the world, in that part of the world, were hitting those beets. And, you know, so our game plan was sunk. We weren't going to shoot nothing. And we'd been there about 2 or 3 hours, because what else we going to do? And I looked down the ditch. We were standing in a dry ditch. And I looked down there. Here come a pair of geese. It was a pair of Egyptian geese. And they're coming from my side. And three of us are in a line. I've got a long time to think about this. I go, shh, shh, here come three geese. Well, the whole time they're flying just 20 yards off the deck, right 10 yards, you know, away from the ditch. So they're just going to pass low and slow right there by us. And the way those Egyptian geese are, they're on a line. They know where they're going. Nothing going to deviate them. So they're just flying. Here they come. And I'm watching. I'm thinking, two geese, three hunters. Two geese, two clients. Do I shoot? Do I not shoot? What do I do? Because if I shoot, then I get a goose and one of them don't. And what if it's only two geese we see all day? So I'm thinking this through. If I had to again, I'd have rethrawled it. I'd have just gone with instinct. Shoot the goose. Shoot the goose. That's what I said to myself. That's what I'll say to myself now. Shoot the goose. Don't worry about that. Shoot the goose. We play as a team. Shoot the goose. I did the right thing. Now, you know, a pair of geese fly by me. I would have shot that back goose. That'd been in my zone. But I didn't. Flew in front of John. John shoots a back goose. Chris, uncharacteristically, because we all misses the first goose. It falls in some, I don't know, belt-high cover. I go out there with the dog. As she's bringing it in, here comes some more geese off the reservoir, so I lay down just in case. And she comes up to me and lays down beside me. I see a band on that goose. I'm like, God, I should have shot that goose. I should have shot it. But then I see another band. Both legs are banded. I'm like, double banded. And then I look up on one of the legs, and it's got another band, triple banded Egyptian goose.
Holy crap.
I'm like, you know, this is what I get for doing the right thing. So I bring it back and said, you ain't going to believe it. John goes, what? It's banded. Man, he didn't just... Thank you, Ram. God, man, you know, no. By lunchtime, he had them cut off, had found a piece of shoestring where he could wear himself a necklace outside his shirt. And the entire time, say, Ramsey, have you seen my new necklace? I mean, just rubbing it in. We became good friends. Good friends. And he was supposed to go down.
I think the thing that you... The main point that you're trying to get to, and then let me say something. Let me add something to this. John is one of the smartest business people I've ever met.
Oh, boy.
He's one of the wisest. There's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. One of the wisest people I've ever met. in his younger days, he was one of the best athletes in the state of Mississippi.
That's right, yeah.
Been very successful, and he's sitting in a hospital bed fighting for his life right now.
That's right.
When Mama called me the other day to tell me this, man, my heart just sunk. It's like, I mean, it was like hearing about that it was a family member that when she was telling me. And he's been a part of our family for a long time, him and my dad, best friends. And he was always there throughout the whole process when my dad had cancer and died. Always, always for my mom and me and my brother. And life is short. Life is short.
Life's short. That's it, Ron.
When you see a giant like that in life go down, it really makes you realize how short life really is.
And it's been troubling me this week because, you know, and how it all relates to our ongoing story about one of your upcoming guests, Mr. John LaMonaco, is people coming to your lives. No matter what you do, people coming to your lives. And if you're listening, they say things. Certain people say and do things that profoundly affect your life. And John was supposed to go with Chris down to one of our Argentina hunts. He backed out due to a shoulder surgery, canceled shoulder surgery because something else had come up. He didn't say what until he told us. Told Chris told me. And he's in a bad place. We've been saying a lot of prayers for him. And from what I hear, I don't know him or the family well enough to go up there. And if I were in his situation, I wouldn't want no visitors either. But I pray for him. And I from what I understand, the doctors have said stuff like that. You know, this is he's with us right now, hanging in there and fighting. Because he was that athlete. He was that offensive lineman from Mississippi State University. He was that fighter. Him and God's got him in this game right now. Not medical science. They don't. It's him. It's his heart. He's still in this thing. And you know, I don't know how y'all qualify success. There's a lot of different metrics for success. But one time, they invited me to come to their big crawfish bowl they used to have. I showed up just with my uniform on, you know, my shorts, my Crocs, socks, and T-shirt, whatnot. My son came. And man, you know, y'all may be surprised to know I really am kind of an introvert. I really, truly, I don't like crowds. But I deal with it. But I showed up. John gave me a tour of camp. And, of course, you know, John's wearing his non-duck hunting uniform, too, shorts and T-shirt and Crocs. And just a big old man and a big old heart and a great guy. And we got a tour of their camp, and we went downstairs, and I just made it. Because, look, this was a who's who of movers and shakers and bakers in the state of Mississippi, especially in the Jackson metro area. It just named somebody. They were there. Name a politician. They were there. And all having a good time and all eating crawfish. And I just made a comment. I said, John, you run around in some tall cotton, fella. And this is the moment. This is something John said to me. And this wasn't too terribly long ago, but I'll never forget him saying it to me. He turned around and he said, Ramsey, are you kidding me? I said, sir. He said, you see all them folks out there? I said, yes, sir. He says, they all work hard. They work and they work and they work and they work and they work. So they can steal away for 2 weeks if they're lucky. And call you and come get to do for a week or two what you do your whole life. He said, now you tell me who the richest man in this room is.
Wow.
I never forgot that.
Sounds just like him.
That's just like him. And I pray for him this week. I really pray for him to find a good place. And people come in your life. And you know, we ended last week talking about Mr. Greg Kitchens in Hinds County, a very successful hunter, a very successful businessman that I came to know at the Jackson Show. It helped that we had some mutual friends. And he had told me, you need to go to that. As he was leaning on my bar to hide the tailgate of a truck, he said, very quietly, he said, you need to find a way to get into Dallas Safari Club. And I realized, you know, hey, that's a path I need to follow. That's a piece of advice I need to take up on. And I had not yet left federal government. I had built Get Ducks. I was still part-timing it at the time, doing the very best I could, working, you know, 100 hours a week if that's what it took. But then I wasn't where I am now. And he's also very instrumental in the story because Mr. Kitchen suggested that I go, that I make the move. He said, from what I know about you, from what I've heard through our mutual friends, and from what I've seen talking to you, you know, you're ready. You've got something that you should put in front of that market. Well, it's easier said than done. I don't know what it was then, but I know right now Dallas Safari Club has a wait list of 600 exhibitors, a waiting list of 600, and it's not easy show to get into. And if you're selling South Africa Plains game, nope, you ain't getting in. New Zealand, nope, you ain't getting in. You got to be something. You got to stand out. You got to be something that doesn't already exist there. That's the way all those big shows like that are. You know, there must be 40 or 50 New Zealand big game outfitters, 75 or 80 South Africa Plains. They don't need any more of that. But just because I wasn't that, don't mean I could just get in. And I put together my application and I sent it, couldn't get in. The following year, I put together my application, donated some more hunts, couldn't get in. And I was actually sitting in a government rig coming back from an appointment on government time when I had this idea, just thinking to myself, you know, sometimes it ain't what you know, it's who you know. So, you know, I met that really nice guy down in Argentina, very accomplished hunter, John DeMonaco, very nice guy. I don't know him well enough to ask a favor, but I should. So I toyed around with that idea all afternoon. You know, I don't know this guy well enough. Who am I to ask a favor anyway? I called him up. And John is, you want to talk about wisdom. Very, very successful business guy. And you know, and I'm not going to tell his story, but as he told it to me, how he achieved success and where he achieved success, really, and my interpretation was that he did so by being a very good listener. Very good listener. And I told him, you know, I met you. Oh, yeah, we met. And, we talked. And I said, John, I'm trying to get into Dallas Safari Club. And
Hold on. I'll stop you right here. Tell the real, real short story about how well of a listener he was, real quick.
Well, as I remember him telling me, you know, he had been a football coach out in California and had met two businessmen from Dallas, Texas area, two brothers that ran a massive business.
This is nuts.
I believe they sold that business to Mohawk. And I don't know what his title was or what he did in that office, but as I recall him telling me one time, his desk butted right up to one of the bosses, one of the brothers. And John said, I just had this ability. He'd be on the phone talking 90 miles an hour, and I'd be on the phone talking 90 miles an hour, and I could take notes from both of us and process that information. I'm going to tell you what, that's a heck of a skill set.
That's a special person.
Okay. That's a special person. Okay? And you know, knowing what I knew about this person at the time, I was very hesitant to reach out to him for help. But a man's got to do what a man's got to do. You know what? Sometimes, guys, you got to humble yourself and ask for help. I did. And And this is a very life-changing moment in my life and in my history, especially in the history of GetDucks.com. We were virtually nobody at all, right? Making rounds on chat rooms and whatnot and different ventures and selling a few hunts. But so I, you know, but I didn't just call and say, hey, could you help me get in? And say, yeah, man, I like phone call. No. That ain't the way that conversation went down. This was a year, I think this was 2008. It may have been for a show in 2009, maybe. But at the time, the world economy was in economic turmoil because of the mortgage crisis. I mean, the stock market was down. Everything was upside down in the world. Everything. Bad as it could be economically in my lifetime. Like the Great Depression type bad. And, you know, remember, you know, I'm not selling light bulbs or milk or bread. I'm selling hunts that require exogenous income, disposable income. And the economy was in turmoil. And John's like, well Ramsey, I've been going to Dallas Safari Club for a very, very long time. And there are some very, very well-established persons like yourself already there. They've been around for 20 years. And he said the same thing Mr. Kitchens had said. He said, this is a club. You got to remember, this is a club. Not everybody knows everybody, but they kind of do. And, you know, they go to monthly meetings. They go to dinners. They go to award banquets. They socialize during convention, but all throughout the year. Well, I went hunting to this guy, and I went hunting with this guy. I mean, they're a network. And, you know, and I said, yes, sir, I understand that. I really do, but I really think I've got an angle. I really think I've got something going on. I've just got a fresh perspective, a fresh vision for how this business should be run. And he started talking about the economy. And you know, and I don't mean just in general brush me off. I mean very thoughtful, like speaking to my granddaddy. Very thoughtful and very meaningful conversation. Very good advice he was giving me. And he said, you know, if I were your economic advisor, if I were your business accountant, I would say maybe you should be in this show at some point in time in the future, but now's not the time to start. Now, when the economy's like it is, and you know, I listened. I couldn't disagree. But remember, if you will, it was when that economy tanked and everybody was running for cover and there wasn't any of that money being spent on these hunts. The competitors weren't spending money on advertising. They you know, they started calling old Ramsey, who wasn't nobody. And I started thinking to myself, well, why is everybody calling me to advertise? Because the main players aren't advertising. And what I saw was an opportunity, a gamble, but an opportunity. Okay, build it. Build it now. And if this economy comes back, and it will, it's America, I'll be there. Build it. And I gambled. Now I was ready to take it up a step. And I told him, I said, I told him, I said, John, I can't argue with anything you're saying. But, you know, I'm suited up, coach. Put me in. I'm ready to play. And he said, you know, I'm going to have dinner with some people Friday night. And I'll do what I can. He kind of chuckled. I think he gave me ways out. Reasonable, intelligent ways out. But I think he heard me say, I understand that, but here's my chance. And I want to go for it if I can get in. And do you know, Monday morning, I got a phone call. Dallas Fire Club saying, we've had a cancellation and we'd like to invite you to join, to come participate, to come exhibit this year.
Now, at this moment, you hear this, Ramsey. At this moment, you hear this. You think that you're going to be, I don't want to spoil your story, but you, in the back of your mind, you think, oh, man, I'm going to get probably shafted in this deal.
Yeah, I'm probably going to be in the third stall in the men's room. You know, I mean, you know, I'm probably going to be handing out paper towels or something, you know. But who cares? I'm in the show. Who cares? I'm there, baby. Boom, here's my chance. I'm in.
This is where it gets good. This is it.
I'm in Dallas Fight Club. And now look, I loved my exhibit at the time. My good buddy Millhouse had built me a beautiful little wooden background, and we put a little grandma's carpet down on the floor, you know, just kind of made it look like a little studio or something we could do, and pull up in a U-Haul, go and rent me a U-Haul, and we load that big bar up, and our little humble background. And we ain't never been to nothing but just a little concrete floor show like Jackson. Here we are going to Dallas Safari Club. And I pulled into that lot. I'm going to tell you, man, I got a pit in my stomach and my palms started sweating. I started seeing some of those trailers, and some of those names, some of those businesses, and some of those and I walk into the exhibitor's hall to find my booth. My eyes got I'm like, oh, boy. I broke sweat, I think. I was a tad intimidated, Rocky. I ain't gonna lie to you. I was more just a tad intimidated. I almost went home. I was like, "Oh, this ain't. I'm in over my head. I am way in over my head." You know, I just pulled some ducks. You know, scoters and whatever. Just pulled some ducks off my and some pictures off my game room wall. South American bird, a few of them. I mean, just I was in way over my head. I knew it right then. I was in over my head. But the show must go on. I mean, it, you know, somebody made a call, somebody got me in, and here's my chance. Here is my chance. And I will not fail. I will give it my best. And we kept walking and kept walking and kept walking, looking for our booth and kept walking. And, I mean, we were right downtown, smack in the middle of this thing. I mean, and I didn't appreciate it at the time. I'm right, you know. I'm in prime real estate. I'm like, wow. I'm in the square of Oxford, baby. I'm right there.
That's
I'm not over
exactly
the strip mall country out of the suburbs. I'm in the square. I'm not over there in the strip mall part of town by Walmart. I'm right in the square. I'm thinking, wow, 10-foot booth. I'm in. I ain't got an open end on either side. I'm just right in the middle of something. I never forget because there was an African outfit across from me whose video that played nonstop had the most obnoxious soundtrack that every 35 seconds would start over. And it was horrible. But I was okay. I was here. 2-3 booths down. Remember that guy I told you I met? Shikar Safaris, the big guy from Turkey that sold all those expensive hunts? Well, his booth was 3 booths down. And guess who worked there? Mr. John LaMonaco. He just sat in and talk to people about his experiences. He was right, going to be right down there. And it was such a prime location. Especially for such a pitiful little setup that we had at the time. I was very, very proud of it. Ran it for 3 or 4 years. That's all I could do. Very proud of it. But such a little homemade booth. You know, it was such that there was an outfitter there I used to represent from Argentina. They were just a little too hoity-toity snotty for our model. I couldn't stand them, but we eventually left them. But I can tell you, he came over there and looked at me about the second day of the show and looked around and said, I ain't going to say what he said because it's very crude, but he said, how in the world did you get here? How in the world did you show up your first time at this convention and end up right here? And I just smiled and said, I guess it ain't who you know. I guess it ain't what you know sometimes. It's who you know, I guess. And John would come down. And I didn't really know John when I set up my booth at times as much as I did when I left him. Because John came down several times when he had, you know, when he wasn't busy. He'd come down and he would talk duck hunting. Not duck hunts, not commercial hunts, not locations, not destinations. Duck hunting. I'd met this man in Cordoba, so I knew he liked to shoot. He was a fabulous shot. He and his wife both are fantastic wing shots. I mean, just in a class all their own. But I had no idea just how deep his roots were in duck hunting. How, you know, some of the most fabled places in America this man has hunted. And he would come down and visit. We would chat, you know, when I didn't have a lot of clients wrapped up. And also who came by several times was Mr. Greg Kitchens from Hinds County, Mississippi. Came by several times, and we got to know each other a little bit better, and we visited about some different things, and he would come by and introduce me to people. He would come by with people and introduce me. And I didn't know it then. I didn't appreciate it then for what it was, but what it was with both those men, they didn't just, you know, just help me get there, but they started introducing me to that club. People in that club, they're people within their reach. They just started making introductions and let things evolve organically. That's very important, you know, because when you're in this kind of environment, I saw somebody on MS Duck today getting just lambasted for being just a scoundrel. And, you know, it was a small world among hunters, especially when you're in that kind of environment. I never forget one time I was set up, maybe my second or third year, and I asked somebody, there was a very, very impressive booth across from me selling black bears in British Columbia. It was just, I mean, my gosh, it was a very impressive booth. And there was absolutely nobody, nobody coming by their booth. Nobody stopped and talked. I mean, the tire shell, I'm sitting right across the aisle, and we're swamped. And I'm not seeing anybody stop by. And I asked somebody, why didn't anybody look at me? They go, nah. They're all hat, no cattle. They words got out on them. They don't run a good operation. And he said, and Mr. Kitchens later told me one time, he said, Randy, the most important thing I'm ever going to tell you about this market is maintain a reputation. Be the good outfitter because word gets out. And I took him to his word on that. And after that first visit, you got to understand, for 4 days, I'm in Dallas Safari Club that first time. And I'm meeting people, and I'm talking ducks, and I took some checks. And it's just this energy, this vibe. What I had was valuable to that market. It wasn't a huge market. I mean, these guys, some of these guys are buying, you know, $250,000, $500,000 sheep hunts, ram hunts, elephant hunts, you know, I mean, some big stuff. But there was a vibe for what I was selling for ducks and waterfowl experiences. You know, these guys didn't want to see scoters. You know, I got it. They're trophy hunters, trophy experiences. You know, I learned that. And after the show, last day of the show, I saw Mr. John LaMonaco down at the booth, standing outside. I walked down there to shake his hand and thank him. And this is something he said to me. You know, a man I scarcely knew. He kind of put his arm on my shoulder, around my shoulder. We were looking down towards my booth, and he says, you know, Ramsey, I'm, I don't know, 80 years old, but my mind is sharp, and his mind is sharp as a cat, steel. He's a smart, smart man. And he said, but I remember a few months ago trying to discourage you from coming here. I remember our conversation. He said, but you did it. He said, I don't care how many checks you took. I don't care how much business you wrote at this show. He says, you did it. You're in here, but you did it. He said, I heard your name mentioned at dinners, conversations, or cocktails. I heard people ask about you. I've seen who came by your booth and who engaged, who stopped, and who talked, how long they talked. And he says, no matter what you think you did at this show, you got to come back next year. You've got to keep coming back because you did it. You're in. And, you know, I got a lot to thank him for. I don't know who he talked to. I don't know how hard it was, you know, to get me in that show. Maybe he just convinced them that we were offering something that nobody else was. I don't know. But I owe him a lot of gratitude, and I also owe Mr. Kitchens a ton of gratitude for his encouragement. And for once I was in that show, for him introducing me to people, helping to pull me into that crowd. You know, there you go, Rocky. They're just, you know, all a man has, no matter what kind of earthly gold you accumulate in terms of success, all a man has is his legacy, what he can do for people. And anybody listening, you don't have to be a bazillionaire to do for people. You don't. Smallest things you say to people are profound. And on the flip side, you know, don't be scared. Humble yourself and ask for help from the right people. Now, Rocky, I'll tell you this flip side, when I say the right people, there's another quote, friend, unquote, that for years discouraged me from going to those conventions. He was in the know. He'd been around since he was 19 years old in this business. Every time I, you know, would ask him, I sought like a mentorship of him. And every time I'd ask him about going to SEI, going to Dallas Fire Club, no. It's just no. You know, there were a million different reasons that made sense why I shouldn't. But let me tell you what. 4 days after Dallas Safari Club, Rocky, I forgot that I had a federal government job. 4 days, it was intoxicating, the energy and the vibe. I forgot. I had to go back to work Monday morning with the federal government. You know, me and Milhouse left Dallas after that first show, and snow was piling down on Dallas as we left. They shut down the whole interstate system. And we had to drive about an hour. I mean, all the interstate on-ramps were closed. I don't know if you know this, but there's like 350 miles of overpasses in Dallas, Texas, and that city shuts down with ice and snow. And we had to just kind of pick our way through the back road because I had to be home. I had a job, I remember, Sunday evening. I got to be home tomorrow for work. He had to be home for his job. And so finally, somewhere about an hour and a half east of Dallas, we got on that interstate. That was scary. Four-wheel drive, 50 miles an hour, pulling a U-Haul trailer. Somewhere over around Shreveport, we was in a pod of about 10 cars doing 50 miles an hour, just in lockstep. Nobody, everybody just perfectly moving like a little 10-pack of cars, the same, crawling through the snow and the ice, just going. And we went over an overpass, a little bridge. That U-Haul trailer caught that little buckle where that bridge joins the pavement. Instead of looking east, all of a sudden, me and Milhouse are looking north. I don't hit my brakes. I don't gas it. I just take my foot off the gas and grip the wheel and hold my breath. I think Milhouse did the same thing. You couldn't hear nothing but seat cushions crunching up, and our butt cheeks flinched, hanging on. And unbelievably, guys that had been behind me, they didn't hit their brakes. They didn't do nothing. The guys in front of us didn't do nothing. Everything just stayed the same. We're moving over that overpass, a little crossing, you know, little stretch of overpass. When we hit that other side, that little buckle, you know, where the bridge joins the road, the trailer caught it again, and bam, we're looking east. Going the same. I mean, nothing changed. It was like suspended in time, sliding. Boom, we're looking east again, like the hand of God had just touched us. I bet you, it was 5 minutes. Not a sound come out of anybody's mouth until Milhouse said, whew, that was close. And we just kept on doing 50 miles an hour till we got to Jackson. And, you know, but that was my first time at Dallas Safari Club. you know, the people, you know, the people in your life, Rocky Milhouse, you know, who humble though my first little boost was, I owed all to him, you know, and people will always be the most rewarding part of this trip. And I hope you get John LaMonaco on this show. I hope people will listen to him.
John LaMonaco, John Taylor, Chris, yeah. Milhouse, the guy that, and the list can go on and on. That's all
yeah.
life is about.
When it's all it's about, Rocky, that, people. It's all it's about.
Relationships.
People. You know, and yep. for me, duck hunting is just something we do. Pursue it to this relationship. You know, that's what duck hunting has become to me. It's not about this acquisition of stuff, this acquisition of trophies, this acquisition of heavy straps, you know. It's about the people component. You know, and that's what we all walk away with in life. I mean, you know, that's just how you can touch people's lives and how they're going to touch yours. No matter what business or what you're doing or where you are in your life, it's all about people.
Yep. My grandmother said it best. Success in life is determined by how many people are at your funeral, not by what you accumulate.
That's the truth. That is the truth, Rocky.
Ramsey.
Well, stay dry, my man.
I enjoyed it. Great conclusion to the Life Short, Get Wisdom, Part 2.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you again, bud. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition. End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.